Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to come out here and face such a marvelous audience. Where are you folks from? Where are you from, sir? Garden City. How about you, sir? Where are you from?
Huntington.
Huntington. All the big city people in tonight, Joe. That's what America is. It's made up of small towns like Huntington and what you call. Garden City. Now, there's a lot going on in Garden City. A lot of people don't think there is, sir, but that's really Action City. There's air and rocks and trees and dirt. It's where elephants go to die, really. Later for that. Good time. How about you folks? Where are you from, sir? Where, folks? Where?
Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus, Ohio. Boy, that's a fantastic town. We have a lot of people from Europe stop in New York on the way to Columbus. Can you really see at Orly Field in Paris, can you see a huge line and Frenchie steps from behind the counter and says, Monsieur, mademoiselle, please, attention, all of you on the way to Columbus, Ohio in this line. You say, what's Frenchie talking about, boy? good town, pal. You're a great audience, man. We didn't expect this, you know, so we didn't have any material prepared. Where are you from?
Tennessee.
Same thing.
Tennessee. Well, yeah, that's American. It's a good state, too. Tennessee! Tennessee! Land of Lincoln! I know all my states, man. Where are you from, sir? Jersey, Jersey! The dairy state!
What about my state?
You mean confusion? Or many a depression. What state are you from, sir? We do owe you that.
Boca, Georgia.
See, you guys won't believe me. I told you. We walked on stage and I said, there's gonna be some cracker in from Boca, Georgia. Are you from Minnesota?
Correct.
Good, that's one of my favorite states. Love it up there. Minnesota, Minnesota, land of Lincoln. I love Minnesota, boy. There's a lot of, hey, Garden City, you ought to go up to there. They got some towns up there in Minnesota. What city do you live? Do you live in Minneapolis?
No.
Fold up.
Where do you live?
Fold up.
Fold up. I didn't ask you what you do up there. I asked you. It's a funny statement. Fold up, man. Fold up. Is the pretty girl your wife, sir?
Yeah.
Oh, it is, huh? She left her wedding ring on the sink when she did the dishes, huh? One of the best things, it always happens in a club. A couple comes in, and I have a couple drinks, you know, and I say, is that your wife, sir? And the guy says, no, it's my mother. And everybody around him giggles a little and thinks, yeah, I broke it up. Then I can tell you precisely what happens. They go home, they have a little sandwich, you know, and a bottle of beer, and they're married, so they go to bed. And he's kind of romantic. He leans over, he said, come here, honey. And she says, I'm your mother, remember? Boy, that happens, man. And the guy says, I was just kidding, honey. And she says, well, keep kidding, Buster. Where you from, sir? Seattle, Washington, one of my favorite towns. Is that right? I want to tell you something. There are more good musicians in Seattle than anywhere else in the country, and most of them went there during the World's Fair because up in Seattle they were advertising the fact that they had a 600-foot needle. See, that's a space needle, a restaurant, you know. Yeah. I love Seattle. That's one of my favorite parts of the country. I lived there. It is, really. I lived there for about a year, back when the World's Fair was there in 1962, and I lived on Beacon Hill, which is all Japanese section. And it's a great section of town, isn't it? I lived next door to a Japanese guy who was so rich, he had a Jewish gardener. Yeah. Everything died, everything in the yard. One thing about Seattle, there's an airlines that services Seattle, and I'm not going to mention the name of it. But there's an airlines up there that everybody refers to as Fat Chance. And there's a small airlines like this in every city and every country in the world today. And they only differ from the major airlines in an administrative manner. And their schedule, for instance. Like this airlines up there goes from Seattle to New York in 4 hours and 10 minutes. And from Seattle to Spokane, that's 300 miles, it takes 4 days. They just do what they want to up there. Yeah. Now, the first time I flew on them, I called the airport, and I learned this. Even large, reputable airlines are guilty of industrial subversives today. They have now hired telephone receptionists with very appealing voices. You know, you dial the number, and a voice comes in and says, "Oh. Well, let's face it, fellas, that's the one you want to go on. No matter where she's going or what she charges, that's your baby. Well, I've been around a little bit. That sort of thing doesn't bother me. So I said to her, "Hello." That'll be the day. I said, "I'd like very much to go to New York." And she said, "Oh, say it again." Well, I very calmly climbed out of the coin return. I said, "Sweetheart, just tell me what time the plane leaves." At which point she checked the data in the office. And then he left. She said, "Hey, Daddy." She said to me, "That's flight 625. Departure is 9:30 in the morning." I said, "Thank you very much. And the fare, please?" $110.20 plus tax. I thought to myself, why not check Fat Chance Airlines? So I dialed the number and a voice came in and said, "Yeah?" I said, "Is this Fat Chance Airlines?" The guy said, "It must be. We got the biggest calendar." I said, "Well, I'd like very much to go to New York." And the guy said, "Big deal." I said, "What do you mean by that?" He said, "We got a lot of our pilots trying to make it that far." I said, "Just tell me what time the plane leaves." He said, "All right." He said, "That's flight number one." I said, "When does it leave?" He says, "Flight number one leaves Thursday or Friday." I said, "Look, can't you narrow that down a little bit?" He said, "Look, buddy, you get out to the airport early Thursday morning. You see, one of ours looks like it's going to get off. Get on." I said, "How much is the fare?" He said, "How much you got?" So I went to the airport, and I, of course, being a family man, put my quarter in for that particular airlines, and I pushed the button, and the lights came up, and the average and the odds both went down and down, and the Dow Jones went down. So I thought, well, I'm going out and try it. So I climbed aboard one of their sleek craft, and down the runway we moved faster and faster and faster, and then all of a sudden it happened. One of the engines started. Well, that slowed us up considerably. So we rest the big bird and bring her around for another shot. Now, this time we got off the ground, and it was a magnificent flight for this particular airline. We rose high, and I know it was good for them, because when we got to Chicago, over 40% of the trees were below us. So I was nervous, you know. And I glanced over my shoulder, and I saw behind me the stewardess coming up the aisle, and she had a large bottle of champagne. Well, I thought, well, maybe a little drink and we'll relax, huh? Halfway up the aisle, she uncorked the bottle and began drinking it. I said, "Hey, are you celebrating something?" She looked right at me, said, "We're off the ground!" She was not a young girl either. Her name was Nancy Wright, and she had two younger brothers with this airline. Well, I had just about had it then, and the pilot showed up into the passenger compartment. He was wearing a parachute, which, you know, you don't say. I said, that's ridiculous, you know. He said, "What are you doing with that on?" He says, "Mechanical problems up here, and I'm going for help." I said, "That's all right for you, pal, but what am I going to do with the rest of these passengers?" And then he told me, and I said, "Do you think we're going to have time?" There are always people come into a club and say, "Aren't you afraid of being sued by that airlines?" It's a two-part question. No, I'm not afraid. And yes, I'm being sued. ladies and gentlemen, quite often serious music is neglected in the nightclub medium. And let's face it, this is a medium nightclub. Our next number is a beautiful song from Europe. This is the time of year when so many people from Europe are on their way to Astoria for their vacation. Consequently, our performance of this magnificent European number, a song from the most beautiful country in all of Europe, from the land of love, mystery, and intrigue, from the land of dignity, passion, and romance, from the land of the bullfight, Ireland. No, sir, the word was bullfight. There's only one country this romantic, ladies and gentlemen. Passionate Poland. Now you're saying to yourselves, 250 cover, but until you've been to a Polish bullfight, you've missed quite an event. Ever seen a Polish bullfight? No. Did you ever see a ferry dock? No, nurse. Did you ever see garlic bread? No, I was in the market 2 hours, it never made a move. Maybe at night when they washed the lettuce and the Muzak's turned up. Anyway, we are playing for you now, ladies and gentlemen, the soundtrack from the Polish bullfight. Now there is a difference, understandably, between a Polish and Latin American bullfight. And the big difference is in the general attitude of the bull himself. Polish bulls are well-adjusted. They don't want to fight. So before the great pageant could start, the bull must first be driven into this fighting mood. Now there are three ways to arouse a bull. Number two. Kick him, bite his ear. Use that one myself. Once the bull has been aroused, the matador enters the arena. He enters quickly, because he just has that little short arrangement. He is a brave man, a courageous man, dressed very much like the matadors we are familiar with today from pictures. The velvet ballerina slippers, the skin-tight leotards, white lace blouse, and the Mickey Mouse hat. Now, at this point, the Polish orchestra files into the arena, and the people say, "Don't do that," and they start playing this exciting background. The bullfight does become very solemn, for the local clergy appears, and he consecrates the animal, and everyone stands and shouts, "Holy cow!" Queens, the next one is worse. I swear. And then the people in the stands complain, for no matter where you put them, they're sitting behind a pole. I didn't lie, did I? That's worse. Well, in answer to a request we've had to do a song on the accordion, we want to do for you a little accordion number, because people come in, you know, and they see the accordion there, and they say, "Hey, man, grab a hold of that thing and really do something wild with it." So I'd like to do for you this wild accordion song, and it's called The Wild Song of the Accordion. Swamp Fire. Okay, folks. First of all, we want to show you how you put a accordion on. Hey, accordion, you're too much. Man, you're something else. That's called putting your accordion on. Hey, listen, will you hear this? Listen, a train. 56 Chevy station wagon. Bomber. Union Pacific diesel. Shoes. Thunder. Rain. A Union Pacific diesel with a 56 Chevy station wagon. Shoes. A diesel with a Union Pacific station wagon and shoes. It's what we call an awe song. It's the kind of song when you hear it, you're compelled to say aw. Watch, you can't help it. This is an awe song. Is a hey song. When you hear this one, you want to say hey. Hey, that sounds like an awe song. The next Cordine song is a serious musical expose. Everywhere in the world today, every major city, there's an evil industry in the form of a Cordine school. Run by a guy who is as sinister as he is brilliant. To the children of his community, he gives Cordine lessons. And to their parents, he sells them big Cordines for cash. Father and son enter the studio one fine day, and the father finds the professor. And he says to him, "Yo, professor, about how much I gotta tie up to get the kid going on the Cordine, huh?" And the professor says, "Sir, your boy can start on this $10 Cordine." And in disbelief, the father says, $10. I mean, you think my kid could play one like that?" And the professor says, "Are you kidding?" And he picks up the $10 Cordine and plays. Impressed, they buy that Cordine. And a year later, the child returns playing. The father is understandably depressed. And he goes back and he says, "Yo, professor, I'm understandably depressed. What's wrong here? The kid don't got it or what?" The professor says, "I'll tell you what's wrong, my good man. Your boy is limited because of the instrument. If you were to buy him this $300 accordion, he could learn a lot faster." And the father says, "300 zords? I don't know. You think the kid could play one like that?" The professor says, "You kidding?" Picks up the accordion and plays. They buy the accordion, and a year later, that child returns playing. The father is really angry. He's so angry, he's beside himself, and he goes back and he says, "Yo, professor!" And the professor says, "Who's the other guy? Looks just like you." He said, "That's me, I'm beside myself." 300 hogs for the accordion. That kid don't got nothing. What's wrong? And the professor says, "I'll tell you what's wrong. I'll tell you right out front what's wrong. Or never mind, I'll tell you in here. That boy has lost his incentive. No will to learn. Buy him this $2,000 accordion and he'll want to play." And the father says, "2,000 brokes? Man, I don't believe nobody could play one like that." And the professor picks up the accordion and plays. And the evil part here is that the only song the professor ever learned was. The professor can't even play. So the father and the kid opened the accordion school just down the street to teach professors. And they told him it's jazz and working at churches in Boston. Occasionally, during the course of the evening, we find an opportunity to speak of things serious. And one of the big problems today is in the science of semantics. Now, those of you with formal education know that semantics is a science that deals in both salmon and ticks. We've discovered that the word bunny in America is a connotation, or rather holds a connotation of something gentle and firm, but soft and cuddly and lovable. And the word rabbit does not, although they're the same thing. Amarillo, Texas, a truck driver staggers into the bar, right? "So what are the roads like out there tonight, Freddy?" "I must have killed 500 rabbits coming up here." I say, "No kidding." "Nah." Freddy walks into the bar the next night. "What are the roads like, Freddy?" "I ran over a bunny." "Aw." the truck drivers go, oh. In the science of communications today, alas, alas, we discover that the older methods seem to surpass the modern ones in many respects. And in particularly in one field, efficiency. Today's systems modified by satellites in stationary orbits, by multi-transmission circuits based on the laser principle. Where is all this written down? We discover that the older methods were better because they were more efficient. And time existed in truly urban areas, ladies and gentlemen, where people were living together 20, 30 floors up in apartment houses. No intercom, no phone system. If one had need to contact the janitor some floors below for some heat, remember the old system? You grab a wrench and you bang on the radio. Remember? And if the janitor below had a reply, he'd bang on the steam pipe in the basement and you could communicate. Now, to prove our point, we need but show you a typical conversation taking place one cold morning between tenant and janitor. I borrow a wrench. Thank you. The tenant rises from his bed and he's cold, and so he goes over to the radiator and he summons the janitor by saying, meaning, hey. The janitor, wakened from his sleep, replies by striking the steam pipe in the basement, says, what? And the conversation goes on. The tenant says, translation, let's have some heat. Well, the janitor can decipher that correctly. However, he's a little juiced up from a party the night before, so, and he's not about to climb from his bed, so his reply, quite frankly, meaning, go back to bed. Well, now the tenant can understand that, but he doesn't care for that. So back to the radiator, and this time you can actually hear a bit more emphasis in his knock as he says, hey, janitor, there's a bit more emphasis in my knock. Let's have some heat, man. Well, the janitor still got no eyes, so once again, go back to bed. Well, that did it. The tenant was enraged. He stormed back to the radiator and said, janitor, you lazy son of a... Let's have some heat. We think the drunken old janitor replied. And then the tenant said... There are developing in the science of communications certain idiosyncrasies which are indigenous to certain areas. When we communicate with a lower form of life, such as an animal, our dog or cat about the house, we say everything in our native tongue as opposed to the animals. Like, if you have a German Shepherd dog, you seldom bark in German. If you have a Persian cat, you seldom meow in Persian. You speak English, but you say everything twice. It's as though, well, a dumb animal, you give him once for the translation. Now, see if you notice saying things precisely like this to your dog. Things like, come on, boy, nice boy, nice boy. What's the matter, boy? What's the matter, boy? Did you ever notice that, sir? Did you ever notice that, sir? Now, we only picked you, sir, because you're a good sport. I mean that. I have a vivid imagination when it comes to things like picturing what it was like years ago, like beer. In the bottle, it says since 1383, and that breaks me up. That must have been the beginning, like someone left an old rain barrel out, and a guy threw some grain in it to get rid of it, and it rained in it. Another guy was thirsty, and, ooh, wow, so that's good stuff. I said, try that, Frank. Jeez, it tastes like beer. Just put it in green bottles and give it a funny name. I've often thought the discovery of America must have been, we must have been estranged to the Indians. You know, I'll give you an example. When we hear today of aliens, or at least the probability or possibility of aliens visiting us in flying saucers. You know, if you walk up to any guy in the street and saw, it's flying saucer landed down the street and the guys from Mars are getting out. The guy says, get out of here. Imagine a typical bar room in any major city and a couple of construction workers with their helmets on, you know. And the guy comes in and says, "Hey, Frank, you ought to see what I saw." I say, "What'd you see, man? Girl in a miniskirt, huh?" "Woo-hoo." "No, man. I saw a flying saucer." "What's that? You mean a dish?" "No, it's a spaceship of some kind, man. It must be about 600 feet around." "Get out of here, man. You need 100 motors to make something like that fly." "Well, there's no motors on it, Frank. That's just it. There's some magnetic force holding it up there." "Boy, you really smashed, aren't you, pal?" "Oh, and there's people in it too, Frank." "Yeah, what do they look like?" "Well, they don't look like us." "Well, what do they look like?" "I'm almost ashamed to tell you." "I want to know." "Well, they're green." "Ugh, ugh." "They're green?" "Yeah, and they got orange eyes." "Ugh." "Oh, well, how are they dressed?" They have these tight metallic shiny pants and big high black boots and tight, real tight shirts and weird tight-fitting hats." "They're not from Mars. There's a lot of those guys around. Don't fool with them." "Well, they have real high voices and everything." "No, Frank, I'm not putting you on. And I'll tell you something else. They got some kind of a weapon I never saw before. It's not like a gun. I mean, you aim it at something and a ray comes out there and it kills the things. I mean, are they causing any trouble?" "Well, I don't want to say nothing, Frank. I think they're stupid." "Well, why do you say that?" "Well, you know them Hondas the kids ride around them, them little motorcycles?" "Yeah?" "Yeah, I like it." "Well, they're shooting them things and they're eating them." "Yeah, they're pretty dumb." "Now, imagine turning the clock back a couple hundred years to a couple of Indians sitting around smoking the big pipe in New York when Columbus sails into the harbor. Right? And one guy says, "Hey, Frank." "I don't think that's an Indian name, but we'll go on." "Say, hey, Frank, you ought to see what I saw." "So what'd you see, man? One of them squaws?" "No. There's a 600-foot canoe in the harbor." "Man, are you crazy?" "No, man, there's a 600-foot canoe coming in." "Man, it would take 1,000 braves to row a canoe like that." "Well, nobody's rowing it." "Well, how's it going?" "They got some bed sheets hung on it and the wind's blowing it in." "Man, you've been poking at the pipe again." "No, I'm not kidding you, Frank, and there's guys on it." "Well, what do they look like?" "Well, they don't look like us." "What do they look like?" "I'm afraid to tell you." "I want to know what they look like." "Well, they're white." "And they have blue eyes." "How are they dressed?" "Well, they have big hats, they got feathers in them, they got shiny swords and tight pants and shoes curl up." "There's a lot of them guys around." "No, no, no, Frank. And they're really doing strange things." "Well, are they bothering anybody?" "Well, they got some kind of a weird weapon, Frank. It's not like a bow and arrow. It goes bang, thunder comes out, and they kill things with it." "Well, I mean, are they bugging anybody?" "Well, I don't want to say nothing, Frank, but I think they're stupid." "Well, they can't be too dumb if they got here." "No, but you don't understand. You know them big birds been bugging everybody flying around, messing up all those Indian statues?" "You mean the turkeys?"